Hello and welcome to the opening bell. My name is Matt Christie, joined again by my friend and colleague John Denon.
I prefer the term bro worker.
Bro worker, okay, I like that. It's very, very close to Christmas. It's 22nd as we speak.
I haven't got you anything, if that's what you're angling at.
No, I don't want anything. I've noticed your Christmas present purchases this week, and I definitely don't want anything from you, thanks.
What are you trying to say?
But it's been a good year, and it's been a good end to the year. Most recently, we've the weekend, Billy Joe Saunders won the WBO middleweight title, beating Andy Lee. Week before that, we had Anthony Joshua and Dillian White. Now, we haven't caught up since that card. You were there.
I needed a week, sir, to get
you
over.
You were off all last week. So let's kind of go back to that. First of all, I think we need to address Luke Campbell.
Oh,
you know, your
still burns.
Your idol, almost. You've got a lot of affection for Luke Campbell, and quite rightly, I always felt you had a lot of belief in his ability as a boxer, and you would speak about his vast potential. And for the most part, I agreed with you. What went wrong on December the 12th?
I'm not 100% sure. It all seemed, it was, for a start, it was he was the last person I expected to lose on that show. Even though Yvon Mendy, the French guy, is decent, he'd sort of, he lost for a European title fight, he'd been the distance with Victor Postol. So there were signs that he was good. I just wasn't expecting, Campbell didn't seem himself. As a pro, he'd actually been hitting quite hard. But in this fight, he was sort of throwing fast punches, which were landing, but with nothing really on them. And it's not like he was up on his toes that much, because his footwork is normally excellent, and he wasn't really getting out of the way. He'd sort of throw fast flurries, which Mendy would take, wait, and then, sort of counter Campbell's counters. I suppose he was coming up against a seasoned pro, and I suppose it is a reminder that it does take time to adjust to professional boxing. It is a slightly different style, and, a big factor, is the distance going from 3 rounders to 12 rounders. It's tough going from, you don't really see athletes going from 200 metres to 400, then 800, then 1500 metres. I'm still pretty baffled by it, but I'm certain Campbell's going to come back. So I've got to stick with what I've always said from what I've seen throughout his amateur career, that he's too good not to be successful, and maybe this defeat will be the sort of ammunition that he needs to sort of bring the best out of him.
For me, it was the most shocking result of the year. It was a bigger upset than Fury Klitschko in my mind. I was astonished. Was overconfidence a factor? Do you think Luke Campbell has believed his own hype in a way?
Maybe. He didn't have that much hype. It was more, I'd like to think I wasn't hyping him. Like, say, take me as an example. Hyping him, but I was trying to say how good he was, because he was a fantastic amateur. The medals he won, and as a pro, like against Tommy Coyle, he did look excellent. He did look really sharp, and with that fight, maybe you can see a difference in motivation. On this, he was on an undercard against someone that no one really knew much about at all. Whereas against Tommy Coyle, who obviously isn't the same level of opponent as Mendy, but he also had that sort of local rivalry and had been the back and forth beforehand, Campbell looked so much sharper and so much on it against Coyle. Maybe motivation, maybe underrating Mendy were factors in that.
Were his team perhaps showing a bit too much confidence? Whoa, hang on. So, do you think his team were perhaps were perhaps overconfident, and this Mendy fight was just too soon for him?
Yeah, maybe that would be the, you know, maybe Mendy would have been the right fight just a little bit later on, maybe when he'd fought a few more, you know, got a few more rounds in the bank. But, you know, at the time, before the fight, I was expecting to see Luke Campbell in the world title mix pretty soon. And if you're thinking that, then why not go in with the likes of Mendy in a fight where you can learn a lot? I mean, if he'd won, he would have learned a lot from it. Now that he's lost it, he's going to learn even more. He got caught with some big shots and he got put down, but it wasn't like he was, you know, I still thought it was a close fight.
But you didn't think he won?
In my brain, I was scoring it as generously as I could to Luke, I think, because I thought a lot of the rounds were close, so I had it level going into the last round. And they were pretty hard to separate in the last round, but I'd obviously give the last round to Luke, so therefore I should have won it by a point. I thought he started the first three rounds like not completely comfortable, but then once he got knocked down, not that he, you know, that he took his time, he sort of, his legs were back under him fine, he wasn't like badly hurt, but the momentum of the fight swung the other way, and then, you know, he was on the back foot. Mendy was the one coming forward, looking like the aggressor. So I think after the knockdown, he really had to change what he was doing and start like knocking Mendy back.
It was another. I mean, while we're talking about kind of prospects being upset, there was another one last weekend, wasn't there, where Mitchell Smith and George Jupp, and again, that was another result that I found absolutely astonishing. I think that one you can definitely put down to overconfidence with his behaviour in the week leading up to that.
Yeah, and especially, you know, Jupp hadn't looked that great.
Not at all. Fought out of his skin as well, he looked to me.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you what it reminded me of a little bit was going back to when I suppose Carl Frampton was at a similar stage of his career, and he fought Robbie Turley, and I think it was in Wales somewhere. I can't remember what the main event was that night.
Could have been Gareth Rees, European title.
It could have been Martin Murray against Blackwell actually. But anyway, yeah, I mean Frampton clearly levels above Robbie Turley, but that fight was nip and tuck all the way, and he just clearly. Underestimated Robbie Turley, and it just reminded me of that a little bit.
But there's always someone out there who's going to, you know, when you're on your way up, there's always someone who's going to give you a hard time, even though on paper, you know, the prospect should be miles above him. There's always going to be someone who's just not right, and obviously, you know, more often than not, the prospect gets through a scare, but gets through it. But occasionally it goes the other way.
Well, no, because I think that we would say that Luke Campbell and Mitchell Smith a few weeks ago were two fights to really keep an eye on in terms of the world scene for next year.
Yeah, Mitchell Smith looked fantastic.
Yeah, so they've both got to go back and rebuild.
But a loss doesn't have to be the end of the world.
No, exactly, and this is the thing, and I hope that I really hope that, I mean, one thing that Eddie Hearn said last week is that, and it was obviously in relation to Luke Campbell, but fighters, you know, must learn that a loss isn't the end of the world, and it's something that I've hoped that fans and promoters alike will realise. You just look at someone like Frank Buglioni, who, speaking now, I would be surprised if he was to go on to be a world champion, but he is in thoroughly entertaining fights. It's not always about if you're not going to reach world level, then your career is a failure.
Absolutely true. But also, you know, Anthony Crawler in the distant past lost some pretty humble opponents.
Yeah. He's
world
did.
Champion now. You know, Amir Khan walked straight into Bradis Prescott, and at that moment, would you think he'd go on to be his, you know, win all the world titles that he has done?
Now, Anthony Joshua, I must admit, while I was watching on the television, in that second round, there was probably a period of probably several minutes where I thought White looked like the favourite, all of a sudden, out of nowhere. Joshua looked very, very uncomfortable. It wasn't just the left hook that he took to the jaw that I thought was made him uncomfortable. He also started to almost look very, very uncomfortable with a few shots to the body. Did you get that sense of, from Matchroom and Anthony Joshua's point of view, impending disaster in that second round?
At the time, I didn't. You know, I felt like there was definitely, like, I felt there was definitely, you know, there was definitely real danger, and especially the way White had, you know, he had sort of a really bad first round, looked in all sorts of trouble, and then especially with the sort of ring invasion between the first and the second round, I thought he'd sort of fall apart mentally. But instead, White came back and had a great second round. I thought Joshua, you know, obviously he was, you know, he took a good shot and was hurt, but I didn't think badly hurt. I didn't think his legs were sort of, you know, going at any point. And he got his sort of, he stepped in for a clinch and then got his hands up. And I don't know if that was, you know, Dylan maybe, you know, not experienced enough to take advantage of landing that big shot, or Joshua's sort of, to steal your phrase, Joshua's crisis management is a little bit better than it was in the amateurs, because in the amateurs he got caught with some big shots, and then it wasn't that he was, you know, he wasn't like sort of dazed or stunned all over the place, but he was like, he was in two minds of whether he should be trying to back off and defend himself or whether he should be attacking. So like when Ant Camaretti caught him in the Olympic final, there was that moment where he's caught with a big shot, there was that pause, and Camarelli was, you know, obviously, you know, an expert, followed it up with more big shots. On this occasion, yeah, he got caught, and Dylan's body shots looked really painful, they looked good. But at the time, I didn't have this feeling that he was about to get taken out. But then, after Luke Campbell's loss, I don't know what's going on anymore.
Was it fair, Eddie Hearn said last week again, he said that he learned more from those seven rounds than he did from any of his previous professional contests. Do you think that's correct?
Or
do you think that's kind of a slightly sensationalist promoter statement?
Well, in the sense that they were sort of seven good rounds and he went beyond three, those are sort of experiences he really needed. There are other things he's picked, you know, and then as a professional he's picked up the sort of ruthless finishing that, you know, it's not like he finished White off when he first had him hurt, but, you know, credit to Dylan White for being such a tough competitor. But, you would have learned certain things along the way as a pro, like, you know, but yeah, mainly those ruthless finishes. And he would have learned a fair bit during his amateur career. Like, he was in with really good boxers, like Camaretti we just mentioned. So I think there's still a lot more. There's a long way to go, because Dylan is sort of at the same level. He'd sort of fought similar opposition to Joshua, hadn't he? So it's sort of the same level as the pro, just as pros. Just obviously Dylan didn't have that into background.
Elliot Worsley contributes to Boxing News fairly regularly. Put something on Twitter. I'm not sure if it was during the Joshua fight or if it was during or after, but he said that was surely Anthony Joshua's Tony Thompson moment. The difference is that Dylan White is not as experienced as Tony Thompson. Do you believe that if there had been someone in there with more experience with Anthony Joshua and had got Anthony Joshua into the state that he was in the second round, that we may have seen a huge upset and we may have seen Anthony Joshua with one loss on his record?
I mean, that's not impossible, but I didn't think he was in sort of desperate trouble, that there was an open goal there to be scored. So I think that's probably overdoing it a touch, I'd say. I don't know, what do you reckon?
The impression I got from television, as I said, was that he was in real trouble. And although, like you say, I didn't think he was one punch away or anything like that from being stopped, but the signs to me in this, which made the way he kind of composed himself again, probably by the fourth round, all the more impressive. But to me, the way he was reacting to the body shots in the second round suggested he was in trouble. And also, at the end of the first round, after basically hammering White around the ring for the best part of 3 minutes and then landing one after the bell, at the end of the second round, his reaction was to look to touch gloves, which to me suggested, well, he's not out of it, but things have changed here. Things have really, really changed.
But then, you know, Dillon deserved respect for his second round, not for the sort of craziness between rounds, but for the way Dillon came back into the fight. He deserved respect. They might have touched gloves at some other point during the fight. I seem to remember thinking later on.
They were starting to. I think at the end of the third as well, they did it as well.
But by the end, the respect had gone. Like they didn't shake hands afterwards. There is still no love lost between them.
Do we want to see a rematch, or would we like to see Anthony Joshua move on from that particular rivalry?
I think a rematch would be good because the sort of, you know, the personal hostilities is still there. The story that made it such a big event is still there. And it wasn't a really exciting fight, I thought. So those are all good reasons for a rematch. But if I was Dillon, you want to sort of, you know, that was really heavy knockout at the end. It's like he was not, you know, it was a huge punch that finished it. You need time to recover from that. So I don't think it makes much sense from Dillon's side to rush into a rematch. And the fight will still be there because if Dillon gets back to, you know, gets back to his best, then if they fight again for a European title or even world titles are pretty occupied at the moment, but you know, if they do the rematch a little bit further down the line, I think that would be a huge fight.
What would be, if not, I mean, the obvious talk was, went to the name of Derek Chisora, who appeared on the bill. He has since said, although he initially said he was interested, he's now kind of backtracked a bit. From speaking to Cali Sauerland last week, I get the impression that they're not just about to feed Derek Chisora to Anthony Joshua after signing him. That's not the plan for Chisora, from what I could gather. From your point of view, what would be the ideal next fight for Anthony Joshua? If not a rematch with White, what would be?
Well, I think the fight with White has shown that they're, you know, that Josh doesn't need to rush. They're sort of good fights to be had at British level. It's just finding the sort of good opponents for another British title.
Chisora's the obvious one, isn't
Chisora,
it?
Yeah, Chisora does make sense. And I think it's, you know, Chisora hasn't looked, didn't look great against Tyson Fury at the end of last year, but he's experienced, maybe not as heavy-handed as Dillon White, but you know, he's been in with Vitaly Klitschko, he's been around a long time, and he held the European title for quite, you know, for a decent run. So I think that's a pretty good fight. Who won the European title?
Robert Hellenius.
You know, that's a good, that's, I don't know, Hellenius is worse than Chisora, isn't he?
Well, Chisora was robbed awfully, I thought, in Helsinki a few years ago.
Yeah, well, you were there for that fight.
Yeah, it was cold, man. Really cold.
It was cold and unjust. But yeah, so I think, Hellenius could well be an easier fight than Chisora, but a good fight to have, and it's for a European title as well.
Hellenius makes sense, I guess.
Who else is there at heavyweight currently in Britain? If you rule out, you know, we don't know what David Price is going to do. I think he will be back eventually, but we don't know when. And he wouldn't come straight back into a fight against Joshua.
No, he wouldn't. It'd be silly to.
Obviously, Fury's the world champion, so he's going to be operating at world.
How about Huey Fury?
That's a pretty good fight. It seems to, I mean, Joshua seems physically so much bigger and more developed than Huey Fury, but Huey Fury's a talent, and
difficult to say
for me. It's been a long day. You know, it might not be the Joshua Fury fight everyone exactly wants to see, but Huey's got a good name value now.
You'd pick Joshua, would you, in that one?
I would. Maybe that sort of, you know, but maybe his size and strength would be the telling factors. I don't know what Huey's been weighing at, actually, off the top of my head.
No, I don't.
So I don't know if there's like a huge Joshua size advantage. Joshua certainly, I think, is taller, and obviously, you know, very powerful puncher. But Huey's, you know,
he could certainly pose him some problems, I think.
Yeah.
I'd be surprised if they made that fight. I think it's kind of high risk, low reward kind of fight at the moment.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Why make that fight when they could fight for bigger honours down the line?
Okay. So if we. So Joshua and Luke Campbell, despite having some issues on December 12th, will both be world champions, you believe, still?
Yeah, I'm gonna stick to my guns.
Okay. This weekend just passed, was yet another big weekend for British boxing. Billy Joe Saunders beat Andy Lee. It wasn't a brilliant fight, was it?
Had a brilliant round, though.
The third?
Yeah.
But I found it engaging. I thought it was a good standard of boxing. And considering they were both southpaws, I thought it could have been worse as well.
You've seen worse, Matt.
So Billy Joe has kind of come out, we've got him as a guest columnist this week. He also graces the front cover, which will no doubt please Frank Warren. He's kind of said that he's not ready for Gennady Golovkin. I like that, honestly. But some of the people in the office have said, well, hang on, he's a world champion now, he should be ready for anyone. What's your take on it, John?
I see what you mean. He's, you know, he is clever, he is smart, and that does make logical sense. But yeah, ultimately, I think if you're a world champion, then it's time to fight the best. So I think the same criticism I've applied to Deontay Wilder, sort of winning the title and stepping down to easier defences, would apply. I think if you're a world champion, you've got to be prepared to fight the very best in your division, and that is Gennady Golovkin. But then,
even though the term world champion is flawed in that there's several of them, despite there only being one world per division. Do you see what I mean?
There is only one world, Matt.
But do you see what I'm saying? Even though there is not just, if there's one world champion per division, it would be absolutely an unforgivable statement to say, well, no, I'm going back down a level. But there isn't, there's four of them, potentially. So if he doesn't feel like he's quite ready for who is largely considered the best of the world champions, but he thinks that he will be in the future, is that really, really a bad thing to say? Or is that being honest with yourself and giving yourself the best chance of victory when you eventually get there?
No, I suppose it's being honest, but, and it's like, you know, if you did fight Miguel Cotto next, or had a unification with Canelo, I'd be the last person to complain about that. But, you know, if Andy Lee had retained his title, he'd probably be fighting Golovkin, on St. Patrick's Day in New York next year, which would be a sort of a great event. So it is smart, maybe it's honest, and he is saying, I think what down the line he'd be better prepared for that fight. It also makes sense career-wise to sort of, you know, have your toughest fight later on in your stint as a world champion. And yeah, I suppose that's why it sort of would have been different for Andy Lee, because he's had, you know, a few world title fights now, and he's, you know, would have needed to have the big one. So yeah, it is smart and it is honest.
Where do you believe he sits in the amongst the best middleweights? Is he just below Canelo and Golovkin? Is he below Cotto as well? Is he below the likes of Lemieux? Or do you feel he really is right challenging up there at the top?
Yeah, I'd have him just below the other world titleists. So, like, you know, I'd have Golovkin as the best middleweight there. And Golovkin really, you know, I know he didn't starch Lemieux in a round, but he really comprehensively beat him. So I think that says Lemieux plummeting down. Beating Andy Lee is a good win, and having Andy Lee in real trouble in the third round. So I think that puts him above people like Danny Jacobs and Peter Quillen. Obviously, I think Canelo is the next best middleweight after Golovkin. Is Cotto really a middleweight? Was his fight with Canelo that close, really? So yeah, I'm not saying I'd pick Billy Joe to beat Cotto, but if I was having to rank people on achievement at middleweight, I'd have Billy Joe at number three after Alvarez and Golovkin at the top.
Interesting.
Just saying. I don't know. What's the right answer, Matt?
There isn't one. Of course there isn't one.
But what do you think?
I think you'd probably have Saunders below Cotto. When was the last time Cotto... I mean, Cotto isn't... Let's face it, Cotto isn't the middleweight, is he?
That's what I'm thinking. He hasn't fought at the weight, and... And yeah, but then, you know, if Billy Joe was fighting Cotto, I'd still pick Cotto to win.
It'd be an interesting one. And when I mentioned it to the guys in the office this morning about a potential Billy Joe Saunders Miguel Cotto fight, Nick Bond, for people that don't know, is the biggest Miguel Cotto fan on the planet.
I think he's the world leading expert on the subject.
And just the mere mention of Billy Joe Saunders beating Miguel Cotto sent him into a near rage. But it's not a completely out there statement for Billy Joe Saunders, who's approaching his peak. To very hungry, talented, to beat Miguel Cotto, who surely is past his peak, and making noises that his next fight or the one after it will probably be his last.
Yeah, and Billy Joe, he's a quality southpaw with fast hands, but
you'd think Cotto.
Cotto's still Cotto, isn't he?
And
it was like, you know, his performance against Canelo was overall a really good performance. I just thought Canelo clearly had like the edge and power, and that was forcing Cotto back. And Saunders doesn't have the same kind of power as Canelo does, I think. Not that I'd like to be hit by either of them.
No.
Or indeed anyone.
So Liam Smith was on the undercard. He negotiated his first defence without any problems, which was widely predicted. Smith perhaps hasn't received a great deal of attention as world champion, perhaps because the guys he's beaten, if we're being really honest, have not been considered to be up there as world beaters. And I think we're being honest when we're saying that. We're not being disrespectful to anyone.
Well, as in, Liam deserved his shot at the title.
Completely.
But the first opponent had to withdraw, so he won it against a replacement.
Exactly.
And then, you know, it's good that he's getting in a quick defence, but Jimmy Kelly's really, you know, unproven at Liam Smith's level. And Liam Smith did look, you know, a level above, didn't he?
Yeah, completely.
More experienced.
But he's got a nice little platform now. got the WBO title. What can Liam Smith do in 2016? To me, he's one of the most underrated British fighters, one of the most complete British fighters, I think. Really, really like Liam Smith as a boxer. What can he do in 2016?
You know,
it's a strange old division, isn't it?
Yeah.
The light middle, well, sorry, super welterweight.
Super welterweight division is, it is a strange one because, you know, the best in the division are people like Erich Landy Lara, but then you kind of think, well, for that fight, you would deserve a massive payday.
Yeah, and you're not.
I just don't think there's huge demand to see, you know, Liam Smith against Erich Landy Lara. Maybe Austin Trout, that would be quite interesting.
They mentioned at the press conference to announce his latest fight. They mentioned that Liam Smith and Shane Mosley had been tweeting each other privately, and Frank Warren, I remember a couple of months ago being very, very vocal in his desire to make Liam Smith versus Shane Mosley. Apart from name value, does Shane Mosley progress Liam Smith's career?
I don't think so, but Liam Smith does need a sort of name to fight, and that's what he hasn't had so far with John Thompson and Jimmy Kelly. He does need a big name, but just in terms of, you know, in boxing terms, Shane Mosley, he should be retired, shouldn't he? It's not a great fight. I'd rather see Liam Smith fight Brian Rose or something.
Yeah, it's not, but you can imagine, because I mean, Mosley, he's won two since his layoff. He's 44 now, I believe. Whatever he says, he's not going to be the fighter he was even 2 years ago, let alone 10 years ago. Whatever he says, and so many fighters do it, oh yeah, I had that run of bad form because I was injured or whatever. Ultimately, they get to a level and they get found out again. But there is almost that little fairy tale thing going on with Shane Mosley at the moment. He's won a couple of fights. He's looked impressive against mediocre opposition, let's be fair. So you can see why Liam Smith and Frank Warren would be interested in that fight, can't you? But at the great scheme of things, I don't think that... It's not as bad as Enzo Macronelli versus Roy Jones. I don't think that Mosley's that far gone. But you'd heavily favour Liam Smith to... And he wouldn't get a great deal of credit for beating such an aged version of a once fantastic warrior.
Yeah. But he's got to just keep doing what he's doing. He doesn't look very impressive. He's got a great style to watch.
Liam Smith.
Yeah,
he really has. I like him a lot. I like him. Like I say, though, it's a funny old division where, you know, the credit that he's due and that he deserves is going to be difficult to get, because, as you said, Erich Landy Lara is kind of, you know, he's the king of the Who Needs Them Club.
Yeah.
And he's a fantastic fighter, but as you said, the rewards don't add up.
Yeah, really, he needs, you know, a big name welterweight to grow the division.
Yeah, that's a good shout.
Kell Brook's pretty big welterweight.
That's a good shout, and he has been making noises about that he would move up to 154 pounds. I'm sure Frank Warren and Eddie Hearn could sit down at a table and get that one sorted in no time. Okay, so I mean we do have to kind of call this one a day now, I'm afraid.
Should we briefly look ahead to 2016?
Very, very briefly, but we've got to give Keith.
We've got to be out of here, basically.
We've got to give Keith time to put to get
right,
this out.
I'll ask you three quick questions about 2016.
Okay.
What fight are you most looking forward to happening in 2016?
That I know is going to happen.
That you think needs to be made and is likely to be made and you want to see.
Golovkin Alvarez needs to be made for the good of the sport. We need to learn lessons from the fact that Mayweather Pacquiao was 4 or 5 years too late. I think that showed in the contest, and boxing has to be seen to be making the best fights between the best fighters, and that to me could be a classic.
My second question is, in your heart of hearts, do you think it's actually going to happen?
I'd lean towards no. I mean, the Golovkin has been making some kind of fairly positive noises on Twitter. They're in negotiations. I just don't think, from being out there in Las Vegas and Oscar De La Hoya's post-fight reaction to me was, we're not taking this fight yet. He didn't say that, but that's what I got from him. So it's not as far away as Mayweather-Pacquiao was a few years ago, but I'm not convinced that they will throw Alvarez in with Golovkin just yet. Golden Boy will throw Alvarez in with Golovkin just yet. So gun to my head, I'll say no, it won't happen.
And my third and final question is, what is your New Year resolution?
My New Year's resolution is to do more exercise.
Yeah.
That will be my New Year's resolution, because I'm getting married next year, John. Okay. I'm going to be going on a stag do to end all stag do's in May, which I hope will involve some beach action. And I need to have a physique to be proud of.
But in your heart of hearts, do you think that's really going to happen?
No, I think when I put my mind to it, I know what I've got to. It's something I've got absolutely no choice about. I've got to. So it's fine.
All right.
So yeah, that will happen. I'm not saying I'll have a physique to be proud of, but
you already do, Matt.
Okay, so anyway, before we do go, this week's, we had the double issue last week. Now, the next issue is available on Christmas Eve. We figured that some shops may not be open on Christmas Eve. Some of you may not want to rush to the shops to get your boxing news on Christmas Eve. You might have better things to do, but that issue that comes out on the 24th will be available for 2 weeks. Inside there is the Billy Joe Saunders guest column. There's a ringside report from Manchester. There is a fascinating Q&A, I thought, with George Groves. And there's the massive, massive review of the year. Buy it, if only to read Frank Warren's personal review of 2015. And I won't say any more than that, but you'll see for yourselves. It's out in the shops on the 24th. Will be available to download digitally on the 22nd. So thanks for everybody's support over the last year. It's been a real pleasure to do this. Sorry we haven't been able to do it week in, week out recently. There's been holidays flying around and various things and trips, and staff have been short on the ground, but we will make an effort to do this weekly in 2016.
You sound like you're choking up with emotion.
I'm about to go, man. It's been,
you for all the things you've done.
It's been a roller coaster.
It's not your fault.
But yeah, everybody have a great Christmas and a wonderful new year, and we will be back in, we're back in the office on the 5th, no, the 4th of January. So we should be podcasting around about the 6th or the 7th, I would imagine. So
if we make it through Christmas.
it's a good point. So thanks everyone, and we'll be back next time.